was teaching and doing research at the university for 20-some years. During that time, he started to escape from the ivory tower and became involved in activities like working with youth and adults, incarcerated youth and adults, and writing social commentary. And this came as a as a was fueled by his realization that we were in a crisis that was very serious, and that he engaged in trying to awaken people and provide recommendations for what we should do about it. Now, that crisis comes from the the imminence of oil and energy depletion, climate change, and the economic collapse or crisis, however you want to phrase it, that we are in. Well, the these activities were not looked upon with complete favor by the academic community, and although there were some steps in between, he has subsequently joined a very different community where he is putting in practice the steps to build a community that is independent of an infrastructure that we strongly believe is coming down around our ears, or will be very shortly. He is he speaks and writes. He has a website known as Nature Back Last, which is pretty much explains the gist of his message. And he has made specific recommendations for four essentials that are going to be necessary to survive and live comfortably and pleasantly in a post-carbon, or if you will, perhaps post-apocalypse society. And these are food, water, shelter, and community. And I was particularly taken by his recommendations for building and nurturing a community, because to me anyway, this process is more of an art rather than a blueprint that some of that providing some of the other necessities of life could be characterized. But I don't want to, I'll let him take it and tell us what he wants to say. I'm hoping we'll hear more about that community building, because to me that's the key to the whole process and how we, what our future is going to have to be. Guy? Guy, first.
Great.
All right. So I went straight from high school to undergraduate school, bachelor's degree to master's degree, master's degree to PhD, PhD to postdoc, postdoc to academic job, first academic job to a tenure track job, and I worked there for 20 years. And the whole way from the time I came out of the womb until I was 49 and quit working at the University of Arizona in despair and disgust, I never took a breath. So you can imagine, I had absolutely no skills whatsoever. I started this project that I'm going to describe very briefly tonight. I could barely distinguish between a screwdriver and a zucchini. And that tells you everything you know, need to know about my building skills and about my growing skills. And it's working. I'm able to go to every day now. I'm a lifelong academic. I appear before college audiences and I tell them, I'm able to go this morning, and everybody bursts out laughing. Professors don't milk goats. One fact, Professor Emeritus is due. And I milk goats for two reasons. One of them pragmatic and the other moral. I'm going to talk about those reasons as we go along here. So the goats, obviously, are the stars of this show. And we'll get to them shortly. If we're going to thrive in a post-carbon world, we need to implement some practical steps towards developing a durable set of living arrangements. I talk about durability instead of sustainability because sustainability is an impossibility. Sustainability is a myth. We emerge from the void, we make a few blinks, we disappear back into the void. And that's true at any scale, whether we're talking about individual organisms, our lives are that. Whether we're talking about individual species, we emerge from the void, we take a few blinks, we go back into the void. Sustainability is a myth. So I want to talk about durability because for the time that we're here, the very brief time we're here on this planet, we can develop a durable set of living arrangements that might persist through our lives and through our children's lives, and maybe even seven generations out in the spirit of the Iroquois Confederation. I'm going to describe the dire nature of global climate change. I used to start by talking about the good news and the bad news, and I start with the good news first. And by the time I got done with the good news, people thought that was the bad news. So it was just very confusing. So now I start with the bad news. And it's so horrifically bad that I don't think there can be any question that that's the bad news. No matter what I say next, you're going to say, oh, that's good news. So the dire nature of the projections with respect to global climate change are truly catastrophically dire. No matter what I say next, I could say right after I describe global climate change, I could say, so obviously a nuclear bomb is going to strike this center of this building in 3 seconds, and you'd go, yes! We're free! Okay, so I'll talk about energy declines, economic impacts, and then just briefly describe two of the four primary components of developing a durable set of living relations in the post-carbon era. We're in the midst of climate chaos. About 3 years ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the vaunted IPCC, projected that we were destined for a 1 degree C temperature increase global average by the end of the century. For elucidating the obvious, for pointing out that we're committed to 1 degree C when we had already experienced 0.8 degrees C, the Nobel Committee gives them the Nobel Peace Prize. They shared it with climate crusader Al Gore. And I suppose that's better than the next Peace Prize the Nobel Committee gave, which they gave to somebody who had been holding office for 11 whole days and hadn't done squat yet. So those are the good old days. You had to do something to get a Nobel Peace Prize. The Hadley Center for Meteorological Research comes along a year later. The models are better. The data are more rich. And they say that we're committed to 2 degrees C average temperature increase by the end of this century. Now, most climate scientists conclude that 2 degrees C is a major tipping point. That 2 degrees C probably means 6 degrees C, and 6 degrees C means runaway greenhouse. None of these models take into account positive feedbacks, including reduced albedo associated with loss of planetary ice. They don't take into account release of the carbon from the world's peat associated with the world's boreal forest. They don't take into account release of methane hydrates and clathrates from the deep sea beds. They don't accommodate any of those things. They don't include these positive feedbacks. So 2 degrees C, by the time you add the feedbacks, probably means 6 degrees C. The last time it was 6 degrees C warmer on this planet, there were snakes the size of yellow school buses in the tropics, and the largest mammal was the size of a shrew, because that's the largest mammal that can thermoregulate at those temperatures. There were no human beings when it was 6 degrees C warmer than it is right now. 6 months later, the United Nations Environment Program, with more sophisticated models and more data, concludes that we're committed to a 3.5 degrees sea temperature increase. That's pretty much the final nail in the coffin with respect to the human existence on this planet. Hadley Center for Meteorological Research comes along a year after the previous assessment and says 4 is the new 2, and it's coming by mid-century. That fast. Again, these models, which are growing increasingly sophisticated and rely upon increasing amounts of data, do not take into account positive feedbacks. 4 degrees C is almost certainly 6 or 7 degrees C, almost certainly runaway greenhouse, almost certainly the nail in the coffin for Homo sapiens. Sapiens meaning, of course, wise, as in the wise apes. But I have good news. These projections don't take into account those feedbacks, but they also don't take into account limited fossil fuels on this planet. They assume business as usual with respect to the industrial economy forever, just like everybody else I know. Global Carbon Project and Copenhagen Diagnosis come along in November 2009 and conclude we're committed to 6 and 7 degrees C respectively by 2100. Those reports were released coincident with the Copenhagen meetings that were deep-sixed by the industrialized leaders of the world with respect to climate change. Because there is no political solution to global climate change. It gets a hell of a lot worse. The vaunted journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Science points out that climate change is essentially irreversible. That CO2 in the atmosphere is so recalcitrant that 392 parts per million, which is what we have now, means 392 parts per million at least for the next millennium. Atmospheric chemistry is pretty straightforward. That's how stable atmospheric CO2 is. We're committed to 392 parts per million essentially forever, certainly on 7 generations. Most people think that human societies can only persist long-term at 350 parts per million or less. And we're committed to 392 parts per million or more for the next 1,000 years. If you just throw in methane, one more greenhouse gas, which is far more powerful a greenhouse gas than CO2, then we're at the equivalent of 460 parts per million right now. 460 parts per million CO2, if we just add methane to the CO2 mix. Just when you think it can't get any worse, you hire a new department head. Oh, wait, a little off topic. United Nations Environment Program comes along and says during 2008, the most cataclysmic recession since we stopped calling them the D word, because that was too depressing. During 2008, carbon emissions actually increased to their highest level since 1980. We can't just slow the industrial economy. We have to terminate the industrial economy. We have to cease burning fossil fuels if we're going to have an impact. In fact, in the journal Climatic Change, an article from last November concludes that only economic collapse will prevent runaway climate change. That's the only hope at this point. People are always asking me, why don't you give me hope? Which really means wishful thinking. Why don't you give me something to wish for? Well, our wishes and dreams and hopes must be rooted in reality. And you want some hope? I'll give you some hope. We know how to solve this. All we need to do is terminate the industrial economy. Problem solved. I think. It might be too late. We might be too far into climate chaos to save our sorry species. It is absolutely necessary, but perhaps not sufficient, to terminate the industrial economy at this point, to allow our species to persist for another few generations. That's the only hope we have. Well, good news. Economic collapse is well underway, and we're right in the middle of it. Reinhart and Rogoff, in their 2009 book, time was different. Looked at 260 financial crises in 66 countries, dated 800 years, and every single time the politicians, the leaders, the economists said, no, 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 we're so much wiser than last time. We learned from those other times. This time is different. Thus the name of the book. You've probably heard that a time or two yourselves this time around. Well, in fact, I agree. This time is different. The current ongoing economic collapse won't affect one of 66 countries. It's not one of 260 financial crises. This is the one that affects the entire industrialized world. When the U.S. industrial economy goes down, it's taking the ship with it. We're currently locked into mad, mutually assured destruction economically with China. China bubble bursts. The human population bubble is right behind it. Société Générale, a big French bank, says in November 2009 to prepare for global economic collapse within 2 years. That's the message they gave their clients. And it's not just them. Of these 58 people, a handful say that the ongoing economic collapse will be complete by the end of this year. About half say it will be complete by the end of next year, November 2011. All except a handful give us 2 years tops. A handful are unwilling to make predictions that involve dates, because then they might be proven wrong. To me, this is like, you know, your historian Neil Ferguson, and you're looking out the window, the only portal of a ship, and you see a hurricane on the horizon, and the party's going on behind you, and you think, should I tell them? They're having such fun. I better not tell them. So that's what those other handful of people are doing, is they're not telling. They're describing economic collapse in terms such as phases of collapse or stages of collapse. They're not willing to make a prediction about when the ongoing collapse will be complete. Neil Ferguson is a bad example, by the way. He's a historian who says it's all over by April of 2012. Economic collapse comes on the heels of declining oil availability. In 1956, M. King Hubbard, working as a petroleum geologist for Shell Oil Company, predicted in a talk and wrote in a paper this phenomenon of increased rates of extraction, it's the blue curve, of finite materials up until the approximate halfway point of extraction, at which point, no matter how hard you try to get the material out of the ground, it declines. So this is sometimes called Hubbard's curve. With respect to oil, it's sometimes called peak oil, or Hubbard's peak there at the top. In 1956, Hubbard described this for uranium, which subsequently peaked in the world in 1980. And in his speech, he described it for oil. In 1956, he predicted that the United States oil supply, oil extraction, would peak in 1970. He made that prediction right here in 1956. Everybody thought he was crazy. And he nailed it to the year, 14 years in advance. He said oil supply in the United States will peak in 1970. He underestimated how much oil was available. He said here, and the dots actually show the data. So he underestimated how much oil was available for extraction, but he nailed the year. And in fact, for that year and the following year, you could still hear the laughter. Look at that, we're pumping more oil than we ever have before. And Hubbard was going, that's right. That's what peak means. Come 1973, OPEC was formed, took a little political action out on the United States, and things started to get a little dicey. Then nobody's laughing at M. King Hubbard anymore. In 1956, that same talk when he predicted U.S. extraction would peak in 1970, he also predicted that the world peak would come in about 50 years. 1956, 50 years, 2006, ooh, he missed it by that much. World oil supply peaked in May 2005. Not bad for prediction 50 years in advance. Well, if we smooth the curve and look at the actual data, you can see that after the U.S. peaked in 1970, And after the laughter died down, we took two political actions to assure that we would have access to abundant petroleum. The first thing we did is start drilling like crazy in Alaska. Drill, baby, drill, because there's oil there. So we got another little bump of oil supply, but at this point in the United States, extraction is down to about half the peak. The other thing we did, 1979, the last decent man in the Oval Office came up with what we call the Carter Doctrine. He said, with respect to the Middle East, that's our oil over there. So that's the other political action we took. We drilled where we could find it, and we went to war where the other oil was. That's the route we've been following since then. So currently, 70% of U.S. oil comes from other countries. The number two supplier for the United States is Mexico. Mexico peaked in 2004 and is in free fall. And this is what happens to countries, fields, counties, states that peak late. Peak late in the industrial game when we have technology to pump seawater down there to get out more oil. We use the technology to extend the peak a little bit further so that when the decline begins, it is truly catastrophic. If you look at the initial countries that peak, they follow very closely to the bell-shaped curve. All the more recent countries that peak extend the plateau for a while, and then the real collapse comes in oil production. So there's a cost to be paid for using enhanced technology to extract more oil beyond peak out on the plateau. You have to find it before you can extract it, and oil discoveries have been declining since 1964, the year of peak discovery. And you can see it again follows the bell-shaped curve, and you can see we aren't finding much oil. You hear about all these miracle finds like Jack 2 in the Gulf of Mexico, which, if all the oil in Jack 2 comes online, it provides for world needs for damn near a week. Problem solved. But of course, they never put those kinds of numbers on it. They just say millions of barrels. And the average American can't distinguish one illion from another illion. They all sound alike to me. So when they say a few million barrels, everybody goes, wow, that's a lot. Not realizing that in this country, we consume 20 million barrels a day of crude oil. We're astonished right here in the front row. Maybe you didn't hear me there in the back. 20 million barrels a day. At the world level, that's 72 million barrels a day. 72 million barrels a day. It's really pretty staggering, I might say, that for the whole rest of my time here. Here's what happens at the world level. It's not a smooth curve if you look at the monthly production. But we did peak in May 2005, you can tell because that big P on it. These graphs put out by these agencies are amazing because they put the label on. Just kidding. Look, there it is again. If we assume a modest conservative decline rate of 4% per year, and so far we've experienced only a 3% decline rate year over year, 4% is a relative conservative decline rate. You can see that we'll have about the same amount of oil in 2025 as we had in 1970, when there were half as many people on the planet and it was far less industrialized. There were, what, 12 cars in China and India combined? That's why every energy literate person I know about predicts that we will be in the post-industrial stone age by 2025. We have to go through a new dark age first. Lights will go out, solar panels will stop working because we don't have the battery backup to support them with lead acid batteries beyond 12 years or so. So to get to the stone age, we have to pass through the dark age first. Post-industrial stone age means there will be far fewer people able to persist on such high quality products as high fructose corn syrup than we currently have. There are economic implications for passing pea, because pea just shows up everywhere. It's like a vegetable or something. Nobody wants it. Throw the peas out. So this is where we pass pea, and you can see what happened to the price of oil. It's a little fuzzy from the graph, but, well, we're in the era of fuzzy math, so I suppose that works. Not long after peak, price went up and down and then really went up. This is when the world's industrial economy was growing really nicely. And so we hit peak price at $147.27. After which, the world's industrial economy went into complete free fall. Nobody needs oil. If you stop driving, stop flying cars, and nobody's flying from New York to LA to sell the next new widget. So the price of oil collapsed down to $32.40. And this is the kind of prediction people were making for years, is that there would be dramatic price fluctuations. Price would not be sustained at a high level, which would actually encourage development of renewables or alternatives. No. What happens is price starts to go up, you get above $100, and suddenly everybody's into wind energy. T. Boone Pickens is building a wind farm through the whole Midwest. Matt Simmons is building wave power off the coast of Maine. Everybody's looking for alternative fuels because it pays. Then, boom, the crash comes, get down below $100 a barrel, and none of that pays. T. Boone Pickens cancels the entire wind energy project. This is a guy who was on the halftime show of an Ohio State football game 4 years ago, and the conversation stunningly turned to peak oil. My sentiments exactly. A little party went on, they did a little dance, peak oil, woo! And so he says, wind is going to save us. But wind doesn't save us if you can't afford it. This is complete destruction of capital right here. All those projects get thrown out the window. Let's look at the impacts of the high prices of oil, and specifically price spikes. Each economic recession since 1972, all six of them have been preceded by a spike in the price of oil. And the bigger the spike, the more dire the economic recession. 10 of 11 recessions since World War II preceded by a spike in the price of oil. Coincidence? Maybe, but we're talking about the lifeblood of civilization here. That's what crude oil is. You reduce the amount available by 5%, say, for 6 months, say, and you get 1973 all over again in this country. Long lines at the pumps, rationing. You only get to buy gas on Tuesday, Thursday, or Saturday if your license plate ends with an even number in Idaho or learning to drive. All the gas stations are closed on Sunday. So much for happy motoring through the suburbs. That was a 5% decline for 6 months. International Energy Agency, an organization that had never previously acknowledged there would be a peak in oil extraction. In fact, they still don't, because they say biofuels are going to fill the gap in a classic case of idiocy at a large scale. Projects based on the world's 400 largest oil fields and also the world's 800 largest oil fields, two separate analyses, they project a 9.1% annual decline rate starting in 2009. So, their World Energy Outlook 2008 put out, of course, the day after Thanksgiving, when nobody would notice, except me. I looked, 9.1% decline rate, there's no way the industrial economy can persist a year at a 9.1% decline rate. 9.1% is chaos in the streets. International Energy Agency had never admitted that peak oil would ever occur at the level of the world. Now, they're saying 9.1% decline rate. They lied, just like they always do. They lied in the opposite direction. Well, about a 3% decline rate through the last day we have data available. Jeff Rubin is the world's foremost energy price forecaster. Let's look at a couple of his predictions. In 2000, he predicted 2000 price of oil was $18. When he makes this prediction, he predicted $50 per barrel of oil in 2005, and the world laughed, and the price spiked to $70.85. 2005, after that price spike occurred, it came back down again. He predicted $100 per barrel of oil in 2008, and I heard the laughter in my office. The price of oil, even adjusted for inflation, had crossed the $100 Rubicon one time, and that was in the 1970s. It couldn't happen again. He underestimated by 50% again. So now I know that you're on the edge of your seat. I can see you. What does he say now? After the economy had completely recovered in October 2009, that's what the economist said, he predicted $225 per barrel oil by 2012. $147 almost brought down the industrial economy 5 or 6 times that I know about. And I don't know much. Lehman Brothers collapsed on September 15th, 2008. Even Timothy Geithner and Hank Paulson admitted after the fact that the industrial economy of the world almost came screeching to a halt that day. Had it not been for their massive and massively illegal action, the stock market would have gone to zero. Of course, the plunge protection team of the Fed moved in and started buying stocks like mad. But it's a free market. That doesn't sound like it is a free market. But Barack Obama says he loves the free markets. Now I'm just thoroughly confused. It happened another half a dozen times. Remember the flash crash, May 6th, 2010, Brian Williams? I remember when self-respecting journalists didn't go on talk shows at night. It was like the president going on Oprah or something. It just wasn't done. You lose your credibility. Brian Williams, May 6th, 2010, he was scheduled to go on Letterman. And he does. And this is a guy who is paid to make us feel good. Right? He's paid to be completely objective and tell us everything's going to be all right. He works for MSNBC. Microsoft gives the news. All 5 major news outlets in this country are owned by corporations. The most surprising, which to most people, is Maytag, which owns CBS. Gives all new meaning to the term spin cycle, doesn't it? Brian Williams goes on Letterman and he starts talking about the news of the day. It was May 6th, the day of the flash crash. The Dow dropped 999 points in 15 minutes. And Brian Williams said, and I quote, "The world is out of money and the emperor has no clothes." How is this making us feel good about ourselves? The world is out of money and the emperor has no clothes. That's an astonishing admission from a news anchor. $225 oil, if it occurs, will terminate the industrial economy within a matter of months. Pentagon's Joint Operating Environment 2010, put out in February of this year, says there will be no spare oil capacity by 2012. So we've been on what's commonly called an undulating plateau of production or extraction since we peaked. It's been only a 3% year-over-year decline. It's a relatively gradual decline. The military can keep extracting oil from just about any place we want at a 3% decline. The military admits we fall off the oil supply cliff after 2012, or by 2012. So the military knows what the International Energy Agency won't admit. The peak has come and gone, and we're headed for the rapid descent part of the peak oil decline. What this means ultimately is massive unemployment approaching 100%. Fiat currency becomes worth less and less until it's worth less. What that means is there will be very little refining of petroleum into distillates, such as gasoline and diesel. Which means, of course, there's no food in the grocery stores with their 3-day supply, no fossil fuels or air conditioning or heat, and no water coming out of the municipal taps. See? Told you I was full of good news. That means the end of Western civilization. Now, Western civilization in its apex, or nadir, depending on perspective, the industrial economy, is absolutely omnicidal. We will kill everything to have Twinkies at the grocery store. And we won't even bat an eye. The average person in this country could not care less what the implications of their actions are. Western civilization is omnicidal. As a further reminder of why this is good news, we can track gross domestic product on essentially a one-to-one line with the species extinction rate exhibited or illustrated here by the number of species listed under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. You can see it follows fairly closely, and I only have data through 2000, but in 2000, they both flatlined. Because under the George W. Bush administration, we stopped listing species under the Endangered Species Act because they don't matter anymore. And also, that's when the lost decade began by most economic measures. According to BP data, there has been a plateau of oil production since 1998. And what do you know? Economists are all excited because the Dow is right back up there above 10,000 where it was in 1999. We've had a lost decade, more or less. So it's too late for a fast crash of the world's industrial economy. It's been a slow crash for a decade or so. So again, good news. Increasingly available oil allows increased energy, all energy sources, because all energy sources are derived from oil. They're not alternatives to it. And what that means is we can grow the industrial economy. But with declining oil availability, declining energy availability, we can't grow the economy, and therefore we cannot commit homicide. We drive to extinction somewhere between 120 and 300 species every single day. Let's just use round numbers, say 200 species a day. So here's the analogy. You live on the 30th floor of the penthouse of a 30-story building. It's a nice brick building. You live on the 30th story, you have this wonderful view, and some jerk moves in right next door and builds a 30-story building and blocks your view. The solution is obvious. You add another story. You need a 31st floor. Where are you going to get the bricks? So you go down every day and take out 200 bricks from the lower floors and take them up to build a 31st floor. That's what we're doing. 200 species a day, we drive to extinction. We're playing the world's greatest game of Jenga. At some point, we take out one or two or six of those species and the whole thing falls down around us. We need those species for our continued persistence as a species ourselves. We cannot kill every aspect of the living planet and live to tell about it. We're going to bring the whole thing down. We're going to drive to extinction every species that gets in our way, and ultimately, we're getting in our own way. A durable set of living arrangements recognizes that the industrial economy is a subset of the environment, not the other way around, as every self-respecting mainstream neoclassical economist would have you believe. He or she tells you that you need to grow the economy so that we can save the environment. Yeah, because that's working nicely. 200 species a day. That's what economic growth costs. We need to use only local materials, no imports, no exports, no bananas from Costa Rica, no out-of-season asparagus from Peru, no cheap plastic crap from China. How will I get along in the world? Brand Earth is just about behind us. A durable set of labor arrangements means we consume materials at the rate they are produced. We don't consume more topsoil than is produced naturally. We don't produce or consume clean water faster than nature can supply it for us. And we don't consume fossil fuels at a massively accelerating rate, far exceeding the rate at which they are produced by the planet. And we need to rely on our local human community for support. What we have in this country is the antithesis of a durable set of living arrangements. We have suburbia. Suburbia was built after World War II as a payback to all those companies that sacrificed domestic production. We had to create demand for material, for goods, durable goods, made by those companies that gave up domestic production during the war. We need to supply a car for every registered driver, or more than one, which is what we have now. We need to supply a washing machine for every house instead of a laundromat like we used to have. We need to supply a house for every nuclear family, and so on. What that requires is that we live far from work, far from play, far from where we shop. That's American suburbia, grossest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. Consumption, personal consumption, drives the economy in this country. According to economists, that 70% of our economy is what you and I spend. We aren't citizens anymore. important to eat it as consumers. These definitions of consumption, or to consume, don't really appeal to me. I want my citizenship back. What this set of living arrangements requires is obedience at home and oppression abroad. The upper right panel is Alabama last year, when the citizens were obnoxious enough to peacefully protest against illegal actions by a bank in their town. So the government illegally brought in the National Guard to quash the protests. Obedience at home. And we don't even need to talk about oppression abroad, do we? We're bringing freedom and democracy to a country near you. And that's what it looks like. Arundhati Roy says it best, the trouble is that once you see it, you can't unsee it. And once you've seen it, keeping quiet, saying nothing, becomes as political an act as speaking out. There's no innocence. Either way, you're accountable. This is why I milk goats. This is the moral basis for me milking goats. I don't want to have anything to do with an industrial economy that requires obedience at home and oppression abroad. I don't want to cause the extirpation of every non-industrial culture on the planet and every non-human species along with it. I don't want to have anything to do with that. So I quit a job in which I was paid way too much money to do nothing. I was banned from teaching in my home department because students were learning to question the system. We can't have that. It wasn't just that showing up is 80% of life, as Woody Allen said. I didn't have to show up. They didn't want me to. But I couldn't stand it anyway. This is the morality behind milking goats. This is the practical reason, the pragmatic approach behind milking goats, is that in the teeth of oppression, in the teeth of what appears to be a dire future for industrial human beings, you can either take action or you can hang back and hope for a miracle. I'm a rationalist. I don't believe in miracles. So pragmatically, I had to get those goats. So I conducted a 3-year search for a property at a moderate elevation in the American Southwest where it doesn't get life-threateningly hot or life-threateningly cold, unlike Tucson, Arizona, which gets life-threateningly hot about 300 days out of the year, where there was shallow water. So the property I found was at 4,600 feet elevation. We found water at 20 feet at our property. We have deep soils, unsorted alluvium, so we can grow things. It's in a rural area. There are fewer than 500 people within 2 miles of us. And it's within a tank of gas drive of Tucson. This is imperative because my best friend of the last 30 years isn't on board with the message. And I suspect she won't be until there's no lights on and no water coming out of the taps. If you wait that long, you might have a hard time getting to the doomsday. And it would be infinitely more difficult if it were 3 tanks of gas away. If we're going to thrive in the post-carbon era, and that's our intent, we are going to see the living planet make a comeback. I'm a conservation biologist. I look forward to that. I look forward to the alleviation of oppression that comes from the termination of the industrial era. If we're going to see that, and if we're going to thrive, we need to secure our water, we need to secure our food, we need to maintain our body temperature through shelter and clothing, and we need to build a decent human community. I'm going to talk about the first and fourth of those just briefly, so we can focus a little bit on the pragmatic aspects. We suck the water out of the ground with a solar pump. These are the solar panels. They go to a pump that's down this hole in the ground. The hole in the ground goes 103 feet. The pump is down 90 feet. And running right along beside that pump is a hand pump that goes down 45 feet. So we have 2 sources of water. The solar pump fills this 3,000-gallon cistern, which then goes to a pressure pump and a tank, which pressurizes the water throughout the property. In addition, we're harvesting rainwater off the 2 roofs, off the 15-year-old mobile home on the property, and off the new straw bale house we built on the property. So the rainwater is harvested off the roof again into these 3,000-gallon cisterns that are stunningly inexpensive. People criticize me for being a hypocrite, consequences of being human. And I like to point out that I see no reason not to break down civilization and use the tools of civilization to build ourselves a durable set of living arrangements. A nice analogy is the pioneers on the Oregon Trail. You know what they built their houses out of when they got to Oregon? They built them out of those Conestoga wagons that took them along the trip. We need to tear down civilization and build something new. Got my post-carbon transportation all lined up? Some people think it's a little small, but I know you shrink when you get older. So this is just planning. I've already dropped a quarter of an inch. I fell off that 10-foot ladder. Oh, man, did that hurt. But already, I'm shrinking a quarter of an inch a year. 6 years, I'll be riding that sucker. And a fourth source of water is the nearby river that is about a quarter of a mile away. Now, throughout the first 12,000 years of the human experience on this continent, first 2 million years of the human experience on planet Earth, that's what people did. They drank out of the river, and sometimes they had to carry it away. Big deal. I got my trike. With respect to the community, communities coalesce organically, naturally. Sometimes you can manipulate the system. When you do, we call that gardening or agriculture. Right? So you're just messing with the mix of species that occurred. You take out the ones you don't want. But for the most part, natural communities arise naturally. We found a community and we just stumbled into it to our good fortune that was comprised of life-loving economic doomers. And I know that's redundant because you have to hope that the industrial economy is doomed if you actually love life. We found these people who've been living in this valley since the 70s, thinking it was all coming down then. And it kind of looked that way if you were paying much attention in the 1970s. It looked like the U.S. was doomed. But we had those two political actions we could take, and we did. We drilled in Alaska, and we drilled all the other countries to get oil from them. Now we got no place to go. Unless space aliens are going to come bring us oil. We're past peak in the world. We're falling off the cliff soon. So there's a bunch of life-loving economic doomers. Let me give you an example. I ordered some straw bales to build a straw bale greenhouse, and I asked one of my neighbors up the road to come down and help me unload the straw, because the guys who deliver it charge $7.50 a bale, but that doesn't mean you can throw one of the things off the damn truck. You're on your own for that. Whew. Well, I had two students did the thing. I posted up about 150 people on the property over the course of the last year. And I had two students did the thing. One of them was 35, the other one's 30. Chris had never held a shovel in his hands his whole life. He's 35 years old, much less had lifted a straw bale. And Sandra, same thing. She's 30. So they got to use a shovel when they were visiting me, and they got to help me unload straw bales. We're just starting to unload bales, and Andy sees the truck coming. He comes riding his bicycle down there. He doesn't even say hello. I don't have a chance to introduce him. And he says, "I was just sizing the oats. Just finished sizing the oats." Yes, he uses an old scythe like this. And he plants and furrows the oat field behind his horses. He says, "I was just sizing the oats. Yep, if the industrial age ended tomorrow, I'd be in pretty good shape, me and my family." And these two students, lifting a straw bale for the first time ever, their eyes got as big as dinner plates. People talk about this? Yeah. In my community, people talk about important issues and how we might mitigate for them, how we might deal with them. In most communities, we don't have those conversations. We don't talk about important issues. We're too busy with Twitter. In my community, we have a thriving barter economy within the context of agricultural anarchy. And when I say agricultural anarchy, I mean in the spirit of Thomas Jefferson and Monticello. Anarchism is a political philosophy and an economic system. It is not chaos. So when I talk about agricultural anarchy, I mean individuals taking responsibility for themselves and for the members of their community, and treating agriculture as the center of commerce and therefore the center of life, as it is. And I'm doing a few selfish things on my own to try to ingratiate myself into my new community. I substitute teach at the K-12 school. Has about 200 students in the K-12 school. Even physical education gives me an opportunity to talk about important things. Entropy. Physical education is all about entropy. And as it turns out, so is energy decline. Hey kids, do you know about entropy? I get to assist with reintroduction of river otters extirpated from the local river in 1953, but we're bringing them back. I participate in numerous social functions. Even though I'm an extreme introvert, it almost kills me to go to coffee every Tuesday and talk with people. No, I'm serious. People don't know that when you teach, it's a very public and also a very personal kind of endeavor. You take all those tests, I'm an extreme introvert, off the charts. But can I put on a mask? Can I do the act? Can I do stand-up? Of course. It's my job. I learned at Texas A&M University. Texas A&M University until 1969 was an all-male military school and still the largest source of officers for the U.S. military outside of the academies. So there's this huge militaristic feel to the place. And when the students come to class every morning, they bring the daily campus newspaper. And it's considered perfectly appropriate that if you don't capture them within the first 5 minutes of class, you're going to be lecturing to 250 open newspapers. That's considered perfectly reasonable at Texas A&M University. That's where I had my first academic job, right? So I teach this class of 250 students. I figured out after the first day that this wasn't going to be much fun for anybody if I didn't make this a lot more interesting. So that's where I learned to stand up. Ultimately, I want to provide a life of service, as I always have. That's easy to do when the industrial economy is operating. It's easy to provide a service for others when we're all incredibly wealthy compared to most people in the world. It's going to get a lot harder when we enter an era in which there are consequences for our actions that extend beyond whether you get a parking ticket. So I'm trying to figure out how best to live a life of service in the future. Ooh, that's embarrassing. The star of the show is Lillian. I promised you'd get to meet her. This is the goat I milked a week ago before I came up here. And this is the cheese she makes. I'm a master cheese maker. I make a killer Parmesan, cheddar, Colby, mozzarella, ricotta, chev, of course. And others I'm forgetting. I just tried my first dill habarti the day before I got on the plane to come up here. And so we'll see how that turns out in a month, maybe two. Hopefully by Thanksgiving, we'll have dill habarti. I'm sorry for the slide that says us what's in Michigan. I know we're not there. It's been a long 4 days. 4 days ago, I was speaking in Southwestern Michigan. Yesterday, I was speaking in Rockford, Illinois. Today is Monday? Tuesday? Today is Tuesday, so I must be in Louisville. So my apologies for the Southwestern Michigan slide. I would be happy at this point to entertain any questions while giving you that pretty girl to look at.
Yeah. Why goats?
Why goats? Goats are so wonderful for so many reasons. They're small, so it doesn't take a lot to feed them. They're browsers, so they'll eat any number of weeds and shrubs when we take them out and walk them, as we do daily, onto the property. They are small enough to be manageable and not require a huge amount of feed. If you have a dairy cow, you get 4 or 5 gallons of milk a day. That's more than any one group of people can handle. There's 5 people living on this property. We get 1 gallon a day out of Lily, and that produces enough that we have some left over for cheese now and then. So, also goats are curious and sociable and funny, and the word tragedy, the root word of our English word tragedy is the Greek word tragedois, which means song of the goat. How could you not have a goat? Every time you walk by, they go, and I say, I know, it's a tragedy. And it is. And they think it's not even funny, but the ducks laugh every time.
Well, so you have other animals.
Sure, we have ducks and chickens for eggs. And we have extensive gardens, and we have goats, and we have a bunch of means of storing and processing food that don't rely on fossil fuels. So we have an old fashioned wood fired cook stove, and sun ovens, and an old fashioned grinding mill, so we can grind mesquite pods and turn them into flour. Blah, 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 blah. You know, the whole blah, blah. So goats are just a huge amount of fun. I mean, they're worth having as pets. I let my dog in when I go to milk the goats. So I milk Lily, and we have a little goat that is named Ellie. So she's just a baby goat. My dog, my 14-year-old dog, and Ellie the baby goat play like puppies. They run around chasing each other. They're a lot of fun. How could you not have a pet goat? I'm surprised nobody brought one today. No, they're really, really useful. They forage widely. They're a lot of fun. So much more convenient than cows. We were part of a milk cow cooperative for a while, and also part of a goat cooperative with three goats. So if you don't have enough room for a goat on your property, you don't need a gallon of milk every day, which we didn't for a while, you can become part of a cooperative, which is what we did in Ontario.
Yeah. Could I see the next slide? I didn't get a chance to look at to read the second.
Edward Said was a very outspoken, incredibly liberal supporter of Palestine, who said there's no point to intellectual and political work. One more pessimist. Intellectual and political work require, this is my favorite part, because you never get to say nay in public. Nay demand optimism. So I consider myself a social critic, an intellectual, and somebody who likes to meddle in political affairs, and could not do that if I were not optimistic about our future, the future of the living planet, and the future of our species. If I were not optimistic, I would go crawl into my hole. I would never come out of my fetal position. A couple of guys who teach high school teach about white privilege in the Phoenix metropolitan area. I met them after I gave a talk, and Lance is about 6'12" and big. And Lance and Michael is like this tall and wiry as hell. Complete opposites. You know, you got the big teddy bear, you got this guy who looks like wire. And they teach white privilege. And they read an article of mine that appeared in the Arizona Republic, the state's largest and most conservative newspaper. I can't believe they let me write there. In fact, it was a mistake. I told you that story so I could tell you this one. I wrote a letter to the editor, a little four-line thing about wilderness and how important it is. And the editor writes back and he says, you know, that was really good. We'd like you to develop an op-ed feature, a full-blown guest commentary. And you can write it about wilderness or natural resource management or, wait for it, anything you want. Ka-ching! Hello! So I sent him the most dire assessment I've ever written. It's all coming down. This was in, 2007, when it was all glory days, right? No high price of oil. It drew 200 comments online. People thought I was, oh wait, they still think I'm insane. Scratch that. Mike and Lance read that. And from the moment I met them, they could only call that article one thing. They referred to it routinely, not by any other name except your fucking article. I ruined their day. The next day, Lance's wife comes into the closet and says, Lance, you have to come out of there. You can't lay there in a fetal position the rest of your life. Why not? I'm very optimistic about the human condition. One of those guys, Michael, and his wife, mid-40s, decided they can no longer tolerate Western civilization. So as of the end of next school year, in early June, they're going to put on their backpacks and walk away. They're literally going to walk away from civilization. They're going to meander south. History has always been kind to travelers, and I suspect that will be true in the post-carbon era as well. It won't be long before somebody makes it here from Chicago, and everybody's going to give them a free place to stay and a meal. What's it like out there in the world? You came all the way from Lake Michigan? It'll be astonishing. That's Michael and his wife, Carrie, hitting the road at the age of 45. Looking for free books about how to disappear so the government can't find them and extract their income taxes. I shouldn't give their last names at this point, should I? Any other questions?
What about old people?
We have lots of old people in my community, and people take care of them. Old people can make contributions, too, in myriad ways. Dorothy comes to coffee every day. Dorothy is amazing. She's probably in her late 70s, and her husband died a few years ago. And people bring her groceries once a week and come and clean her house once a week. And in exchange, Dorothy has provided service to the community throughout her life and now goes to coffee, where she's the world's biggest flamethrower. The conversation starts to die down a little bit, and she'll say something like, "What do you guys think about a pedophile sex offender who has served his time? Should we let him teach in the public schools?" You can always count on Dorothy to keep the conversation moving along. Dorothy doesn't want to talk about insignificant crap anymore. She doesn't go on Facebook. She doesn't watch American Idol. She provided years of service to that community, and the community is providing service back. That's what happens to people who provide service to their community. They are taken care of. At some point, of course, as John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. So at some point, we're all going to die, and it won't be so sterile as it is today. But we hope that people will have dignity in their lives and dignity in their deaths.
So you moved to find a community. Did you consider staying where you were and building something? Because it's not going to be an option for a lot of people.
That's right. It's not. I didn't seriously consider staying in Tucson, Arizona, a town of 1 million people to which I had grown enormously attached. My wife and I bought our first house ever there. It was a house that we were going to retire, grow old, and die in. It was a single-story house so that we could get around when we were old. We had levered doors. It was a house in the suburbs built for living and dying in. But I didn't want that death to come in a year or two. So we traded in that house. We sold it to buy the Straw Bale House. I don't think a city of 1 million people that relies on fossil fuels to dig water out of the ground from 800 feet below ground is a viable option in the not-too-distant future. I don't see 1 million people, 1 million hyper-indulgent people, getting along without air conditioning, food at the grocery store. In addition, cities are the apex of empire. They extract everything from the surrounding areas, and they give back two things, pollution and garbage. I am violently, vehemently opposed to the apex of the industrial economy, to the apex of civilization, cities. You know who built the world's first cities? Cain couldn't wait. The biblical story of Genesis is a story about the fall from the garden and into civilization. Civilizations only arose a few thousand years ago. Cities are the apex of that. They allow storage of food and therefore control of people, obedience at home and oppression abroad. So I don't want to live in a city. I finally saw it, and now I can't unsee it. Every day I wish I could unsee it. Friday, my partners are coming back from their trip to New York for the last time they think they'll see their families. They drove 24 days, they're coming back Friday afternoon, I leave Friday morning. Well, there was a leaky roof in the mobile home. I thought it was no big deal, I can wait for a while. Geez, I live in the desert, it never rains there, right? Rained an inch Thursday night. I walk into the mobile home on Friday morning. I've been by myself on the property for 24 days, I haven't had much human contact. I've been bemoaning the fact that I'm not spending the semester with young people who I love. I'm not teaching, which I do really very well, and which sustains me. And so I'm feeling a little down. And I walk into the mobile home to get the milking bucket, and there's the ceiling of the mobile home, but it's on the floor. I cried for a half an hour. Friday morning, thinking I had made the worst mistake of my life. There will be considerable time for self-doubt in the future about any decisions you make. I think I made the right choice, even though I'm living without my wife, from a moral perspective and also from a pragmatic perspective. But it haunts me every day. So yours is a great question. I don't think there's a viable moral or pragmatic reason to live in a large city, so I couldn't do it anymore. It's going to be tough, because more than half the people in the world, more than half the people in this country live in cities. And I don't see that as being a viable option in areas that don't grow enormous amounts of food in the surrounding area to import to those people.
Well, I was going to say that Barbara Kingsolver wrote a book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, and she said she went from Arizona up to Kentucky, Virginia, so if you're...
Tucson to Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so if it gets kind of, sparse down in Arizona for your friends, they can come on up, because we got a lot of land here.
I'll send them right on up. Currently, everybody's moving out of this part of the world, moving down there. Well, not so much lately, since the big crash.
Didn't I read something on your blog today about the Southwest was, from now on, the permanent dust bowl?
That's right. All the climate projections indicate that we have entered a permanent dust bowl that will be screamingly obvious by 2020. That, in addition, there's all kinds of evidence emerging lately that at the world level, climate change will be so catastrophic that our ability to grow food will be threatened within a decade. Yes, Tucson and the surrounding area has entered a permanent dust bowl.
So then is that the place to move?
No. I think what...
200 miles from Tucson.
Well, 200 miles from Tucson is still not good.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a friend... I talked to him a while ago. I used to live in New Mexico at Cruces, and he said the only place in the whole Mesilla Valley, the Stallman Farms, is the only pecan orchard left because there's no water for the pecan trees anymore, and every single farm besides Stallman's, which they have over a million trees, they can't afford to quit, but everybody else gave up because they couldn't do it anymore.
Right. Southwest is a terrible place to be. It would not be my first choice. But my best friend of the last 30 years will not leave until it's either just barely too late or just barely not too late. So these are the kinds of sacrifices we make. In 2005, I got 30 of my friends together, including my family members, and we had a meeting in my living room. And I talked about developing an off-grid community for the post-carbon era. This is 2005. Price of oil was $50. Everybody thought I was crazy. It hasn't gone away, oddly enough. I just learned recently I have this fatal brain disease. This is the rumor going around academia. That's what made me crazy. I posted on my blog recently. I hope it's not fatal. One of the people who comments on my blog regularly says, I hope it's quickly contagious. So there are far, far, far better places to be than the American Southwest in a post-carbon era. This is one of them. The area around here can actually support a few people. Bear in mind, though, that North America was full in 1491. Humans had been here for 12,000 years. North America was pretty full. Had 10 million people. I suspect in the absence of fossil fuels, North America can only support, over the long term, at most 10 million people. We have so degraded the water supply and the soils, we flushed all the soil down to the Gulf of Mexico, and then it got covered with oil, so it's not really worth anything now. And all the water, instead of being free-flowing surface water that you could actually drink, now it's all contaminated 800 feet down. 1491, there are two free-flowing perennial rivers in Tucson, Arizona. That was 800 feet of water. So, I don't think North America is going to support nearly the human population that it currently has. I don't think it can. That's what overshoot means. William Catton wrote about it in his book in 1980, 30 years ago now. We know what overshoot is. We know that every population of organism, when given abundant resources, overshoots the resource base, and we know what happens in the aftermath of that overshoot. There's a correction. Frequently, it's a crash. Humans are not that special. We're animals, too. So I suspect there will be far fewer of us in 2025 than there are now. I don't say this with great happiness.
Much of you stayed in the current economic system with regards to money resources, you know, all your stocks and bonds and retirement systems, maybe converted to gold and silver. What's your thinking about?
That's a great question. My thinking is you can't eat gold and silver tastes like crap. So I invested in durability. 2004, 2005, when I heard about peak oil, I transferred all my retirement money into cash away from the casino, I mean the stock markets. And when I left the university, one of the reasons I left was so that I could cash out all my retirement money and take the associated penalties. It wasn't going to be there when I reached a legitimate retirement age in 15 years. So I left at the age of 49, took the hit, and used that money to build a durable set of living arrangements. That's why when I travel to speak, somebody has to pay my expenses. I stay in a kind host's house, like George and Joan Perkins, and I eat their food. And somebody pays for my airline ticket. Because I have joined the rural poor. I invested all of my money into durable goods. Those durable goods are intended to provide a service to the community in the years ahead. We have a pretty extensive PV solar system. It's going to produce far more electricity on most days than we're able to use. So what that means is anybody needs work done with some power tools, anybody needs electricity for a while, anybody who needs water from our pump in our community is welcome to use it. We're making plans with community in mind, investing in durability. It's a strongly anti-American sentiment.
That brings up my next question, which is, what is some attributes of a collective proactivity that we can do, otherwise known as kind of some governmental collective policy to strive for, i.e. politics, like green revolution turns into anarchy, which is where we should be?
Yeah, and of course that's never going to fly at the level of the federal or state government, probably not even county government. Nobody's going to elect somebody who's going to run on the promise of economic contraction, right? A lot of people in this country, when I give a talk not too dissimilar from this one in Silver City, New Mexico, a week and a half ago, there were a bunch of kids there from an alternative high school, Aldo Leopold High School. Aldo Leopold was a great conservationist. So a 15-year-old student says, well, it seems to me that what we need to do is change the politicians. If the leaders are not helpful, if there is indeed comprehensive failure of leadership on the issues of peak oil and climate change, as I believe there are, then what we need to do is change the leadership. So my response to that is, can we change the leadership? Yes, we can. We tried that. Remember? The hope, the change, the promise of reform and transparency? That's what got Gorbachev in office. We have the American Gorbachev. We're the next superpower to go down. We can't. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So there is no large-scale solution. There is only community action at the small scale. You cannot look to the federal government or the state government. There are three Chinese curses. Most people know about the least dire of them. May you live in interesting times. That's a Chinese curse. The second most dire, fewer people know about it. May you attract the attention of the government. 2005, I'm on the phone to then-Governor Janet Napolitano's lead staff for energy and also agriculture and natural resources. And I'm jumping up and down, screaming on the phone, saying, you don't understand. We're about to pass the world oil peak. At that point, it wasn't clear that we had passed the world oil peak. We're about to pass the world oil peak. This is a big deal. You should be concerned about this. They said over and over and over for an hour and a half on the telephone, they said, there's nothing we can do. This is the governor's office. You're telling me there's nothing you can do? But in fact, that's right. There is no viable political solutions. These are predicaments. These are not problems. Problems have answers. You turn to the back of the book 7A, no, it's 12. The answer is 12. These are predicaments. They have no solutions. Actually, I have a solution for global climate change. To terminate the industrial economy. But that's not a politically viable solution. Nobody's voting for that one. The most dire of the Chinese curses, number one, is may you find what you're looking for. That's the one I have left. I have attracted the attention of the government. We all live in interesting times, as we always have for the first 2 million years of the human experience. May I find what I'm looking for. Completion of the ongoing collapse. It's all about community. Answer your question. It's all about local communities. You have to secure your water supply for your local community. You have to secure your food supply. You can't rely on a 3,000-mile supply chain. The days of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad are just about behind us. Cheap oil forms the foundation for the 12,000-mile supply chain underlying the just-in-time delivery of based on where warehouse on wheels approach.
Can I have your attention, please? The library will be closing in 30 minutes. If you wish to check out any materials, please come to the checkout desk in the lobby on the first floor. And thank you for visiting the library.
Thank you.
Warehouse wheels on what?
Warehouse on wheels
approach is a just-in-time delivery of cheap plastic crap. So those days are just about behind us. We need to form small communities in which we are actually responsible for ourselves and for our neighbors. I don't think you can do that in a town with a million people. I don't think it can work at that scale. I know what that means for industrial human beings. But every day in Overshoot is 205,000 people we need to deal with later. We add 205,000 people a day to this planet. Every single day. Every day the industrial machine of death keeps going means we have 205,000 people we need to deal with later. The faster we terminate the industrial economy, the fewer people suffer. And certainly the fewer species go extinct and suffer along the way. We have 29 minutes remaining. One of the funniest people I ever heard talk was an ecologist named Tom Stolgren. He could do stand-up like you can't believe. And he's given a talk. There's 400 people in the audience. And he takes a breath. And somebody in the intercom says, hello? Tom takes one quick look around and he says, God? I didn't know for sure. Pretty impressive. I like that. Yes, you had a question in the back.
My sense is that one of the things that will be most problematic for us will be the things that we tend to cling to too long in terms of taking action, whether it's property that we own or the idea that we can prolong the way things are in our lives for just a little bit longer. Can you comment on that?
Yes. We have a set of living arrangements that is patently unsustainable by any definition except Walmart. Walmart has this big sustainability initiative.
Local food.
Exactly. Oh yeah. When I think sustainability, the first thought that comes to mind is lower prices, always.
Now it's save money, live better.
About 2 or 3%. They snuck it in, no signs anywhere.
I think you're right. We cannot sustain the unsustainable. And this is clearly an unsustainable set of living arrangements. Of course we want to hold on to it. Of course I cried Friday because of what I gave up. Of course it's wonderful living at the apex of empire, especially if we just don't think about the consequences of our daily actions. How long can we keep this going? I don't know. I don't know. I know that empires don't break up. Empires break down. And this one is breaking down. I think we're in the acceleration phase of that breakdown. I think the empire has been breaking down since 1979, when we had maximum oil production per capita on the planet. And Jimmy Carter imposed the Carter Doctrine. That's when I think we started circling the drain. I think we lost two pivotal moments. September 12, 2001, everybody in the world was on our side. Dick Cheney started speaking about peak oil in 1999. The entire Bush cabinet, first term, was comprised of oil executives. We still haven't seen the Energy Task Force documents, have we? We don't know what went on in those rooms with Dick Cheney and the Energy Task Force. Why don't we know? I strongly suspect it's because they were talking about global peak oil and what to do about it. We missed a moment on September 12, 2001. We missed another one when Barack Obama was elected. He could have told the country that was behind him that we're headed for economic contraction, not for economic growth. But now all he talks about is how we're going to grow this economy. He knows that can't work over the long term. It's time we gave up on national level politicians and got our acts together. I mean, I keep returning to that same theme, but soon enough, everything will be local. Soon enough, you won't know what happens in Washington, D.C. or Chicago, Illinois. That won't matter to you anymore. I would argue that it doesn't matter now. So I'm not going to say by what date we have lights out in the empire. But I will say we'll be in the post-industrial stone age in 15 years. I will say that sometime between now and then, we're going to have the lights go out for the last time. The water will stop coming through the taps. And along the way, every city becomes Detroit. Empires break down. The signs are everywhere. I think that's right, and for individuals, I recognize the difficulty. You need to make money to generate a durable set of living arrangements. Or maybe it's and, at the same time, you need to work together with people to develop that durable set of living arrangements. My wife and I lived on 1/3 of our income for 20 years. We socked the other third into my retirement accounts. Geez, that was a genius. And the other third we gave to the federal and state governments, which is fine. I got no problem with paying taxes. They paid a whole bunch of that back to me every year, after all, in my salary. But we still didn't have enough money to do what we're doing. We had to form a community. We had to work together with people in a strictly un-American way, not exhibiting our American independence at all, by occupying a house, a duplex, with another couple and their 7-year-old son. Oh, and did I mention I have a 7-year-old now? Yeah, that kind of happened all at once. No diapers or anything. That was the cool part. I remember the lawyer, when we were putting together our tenancy and common agreement, we were explaining to him what we wanted to do. And he kept trying to talk us out of it, talk us out of it, talk us out of it. You don't want to do this, you don't want to do this, you don't want to do this. You don't know each other all that well. And finally he turns to my partner on the property and he says, what are you going to do? You come home someday, she's beating your kid and he's fucking your wife. His exact words. Lawyers have a way with words. Everybody talks about any speech? Yeah, right. 3 days later, we're working on the property, and I'm pulling nails out of a shed. We're rebuilding the vault on it. And Hawk, the then 4.5-year-old, walks up behind me to check out what's going on. I pull the nail out and smack my elbow into his face. We're halfway there. Already I'm beating the kid. We're going to have to trust each other. We're going to have to work with people in ways we have never experienced in our lives, because all we've ever known is economic growth. All we've ever known is free money, free electricity, and essentially free water coming out of the taps. But there's a cost for all that. It's not free. We have to kill everything that gets in the way. So we're going to have to partner up with people in ways to which we're entirely unaccustomed and which culture tells us is the wrong thing to do. Culture tells us he's going to be beating your kid and fucking your wife. Yeah.
To what extent do your neighbors, that is, joining properties, you talked about going to the coffee house and so on, do they pretty much buy into this, you know, we need to hang together because
otherwise,
we're going to need each other. You haven't said a lot about, you know, your household.
Right.
Household.
Right. No, that's a great question. There's about a third of the people in the valley who moved there in the 1970s as part of the original Back to the Land movement, and consequently became very self-reliant. There's a guy who makes wood stoves, wood heating stoves. Who makes wood heating stoves? Nobody knows how to do that. There's a self-taught blacksmith. At the age of 20, he was a blacksmith, and he makes anything. He makes flutes, didgeridoos. Nobody plays a didgeridoo. Why'd you make that? Every time I say that, somebody raises their hand. No, I do.
I do, but I can't.
See what I'm talking about?
I gave it away, though.
Well, yeah, of course you did.
I couldn't do circular breathing, and like, when do you have an opportunity to play your didgeridoo?
Bingo! The guy makes didgeridoos. There's a full moon drumming every full moon in the valley. All the hippies get together, smoke dope, talk about the full moon. You don't have to smoke dope. I don't. So this guy makes all kinds of things. Guitars, bows and arrows. He knows where we're going. He really does. A whole bunch of people, a third of the people I'd say know where we're going. Another third are the cowboys who work for the local cattle company. Now it's interesting because that's the other form of American independence that is maybe on the other end of the political spectrum from the dope-smoking hippies, right? And then there's a bunch of people in the valley who are more mainstream, maybe affiliated with the Mormon church. There's a relatively large Mormon contingent there, and so on. So it's a mixed bag. There's a whole bunch of people, though, that know where we're going and think it's a good thing. There's a bunch more who are these very independent-like people. And it's funny, New Year's Eve, we crashed a party. A New York City literary agent was throwing a party in his new house. And now I know where the money goes. I knew it didn't go to authors, because I've done 9 books, and they've generated about $12 for me total. There's no money in writing books. Apparently the publishing houses don't make any money, to hear them tell it. Whole publishing industry in the freefall. This guy's a literary agent. Holy cow! He's got a house about twice the size of this library, and he's got 12 flat-screen TVs in his office, and they're all on. It's astonishing. It's really pretty impressive. That's where the money goes. He throws a party. We weren't invited, but our friends were invited, so that's close enough. So we walk in, there's 200 people there, and they welcome us very graciously. And the 200 people include the 20 people from the land trust who live a mile up the road from us. They're all off-grid, they share a common well in the center of their community. There's 20 people living there, all off-grid in various housing arrangements, and they share a common source of water. They're all there. The cowboys are there, dressed to the nines, you know, ostrich skin boots and all vests and hats and everything. So you got what are supposed to be the very conservative people and what are obviously the very liberal people, and they're all there talking to each other. They're off in a corner. I saw a cowboy from a mile down the road talking with Joseph, who hate to say it to Joseph, he stops by about once a week to barter for eggs with us, but he really needs to take a shower sometime this year. And so, from that perspective, he really doesn't fit in at this massive scale party. And there's these New York women, the daughter of the guy who's throwing the party. She's 6'2" with her 9-inch heels, and she weighs 38 pounds. And she's got her and her little New York friends flitting around the group room, refusing to look at any of the rest of us. And we got the whole valley there. You got these cowboys, you got these hippies, you got these Mormons, you got everybody shaking hands and getting along as if we're all neighbors. Because we are. My first exposure to the valley, I did my last sabbatical leave there, and I was asked to give a talk at a community center. And the day of the talk, I asked the person organizing, how long should I talk, like 15 minutes? She said, oh, no, this will be an event. You got to talk for an hour. So I put together something. I'm a professor, so I can profess all day. And so I put together something. I talked for 50 minutes, because that's what my clock says. And then I orchestrated a 2.5-hour discussion. 2.5 hours. Nobody in that room agreed on anything, except that they agreed to disagree. And they were civil for 2.5 hours. Nobody raised their voice. Mary Risley is so adamant that we will never put Roundup on anything. I don't care what happens. And the cowboys are saying, you know, we got cameras choking the entire stream, and we can't go in and pull them all out. That'd be far more disruptive than Roundup. We're not putting Roundup on anything. She gets arrested every month or so for protesting on military bases. They didn't agree on anything. They were incredibly civil. I have no doubt that if Mary ran off the road in an ice storm, that if a cowboy who disagreed with her on every issue was the next car to come along, he would pull her out. He would have to. If he drove away and people heard about it, he better not come back. Small communities get together. They have to. Because they're neighbors. Did you want to say something?
I think, no, I cannot say anything.
May I have your attention, please?
She's a woman, I guess.
Wish to check out any materials, please come to the checkout desk in the lobby on the first floor of the library.
They even send security after us.
No, that's just from my benefit. That is wrong.
There it is.
I just wanted to see if there was anybody still down here. Closing in 15 minutes.
Nobody here.
There's certainly nothing I can add. Grateful, and I appreciate the personal insight and profoundly challenged. And I hope. Hope the rest of you feel the same way. I do have to give a little bit here. I appreciate the contributions to, please join us on October 9th. That's the regular meeting of our peak oil group. I'm